Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We thought this hour we would talk about two under-the-radar news stories that we found fascinating. First, a Yale University-led group of astronomers, along with citizen scientists, who announced last week their discovery of a new planet. Joining us in just a few moments, Alan Pesch, who is director of the Barlow Planetarium in Menasha, will be joining us. And later this hour, art theft. There was a huge art theft last week of Picasso, Monet, Matisse, and other paintings at the Kunsthal Museum in Rotterdam. I don't know why you steal art. Who would you sell it to? Because wouldn't people know this is stolen art, and what can you do with it? It's a fascinating area of discussion, and we will be talking about that with the author of Stealing Rembrandt's The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. All hour for both subjects. You are welcome to join us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Alan Pesch is our guest. Been a while since we spoke with Alan. We had the great pleasure of being in his planetarium a couple of years ago. He's director of the Barlow Planetarium in Menasha and knows a whole lot about space. Alan, thank you very much for being with us. Good morning.
Good morning, Kathleen.
So there was a new planet discovered last week. Was this a big deal?
Well, if we go back over a century, we can go to Lord Kelvin. And Lord Kelvin, sometimes people make quotes that aren't, that in the now in the future seem really, really bad. He said at that point around 1900 that no new stuff in physics will ever be discovered. Now it's only going to be better measurement. Of course, a lot of stuff has changed since he made that comment. However, what we're seeing now with these exoplanets is our ability to more finely tune measurements and be able to see things that have always been there, but our technology would just not allow. And whether it's these guys who discovered this planet around Alpha Centauri B, or the new Kepler spacecraft, which has discovered hundreds of new planets already, going around other stars at stars much more distant than Alpha Centauri, I mean, it's showing that our technology is catching up, is actually showing us that the Earth and our solar system is not unique in the universe. Hmm. It's pretty typical.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me about this new technology. It allows us to see how far away.
Well, our newest discovery, this is pretty good because this is one of the closest star systems to us. The Alpha Centauri system has two stars in it, an A and a B. And there's also Proxima Centauri, which in science, people will know from science that Proxima Centauri is actually considered our closest star to us other than the sun. So these stars are only a little bit more than 4 light years away, about less than 25 trillion miles away. In space terms, that's across the street. And what happened with this star, because it's so close, and we have this ability, we can actually see the star, which is about the size of the sun, a little bit smaller, wobble because there's a planet going around it that's actually pulling it off its center, much like a child pulls a parent off its center when they're swinging them around. And this group was able to measure that wobble, determine the orbit, a good orbit and a period of the orbit of this planet, and kind of figure it out. It, as much as it was wobbling, it's not that different in size than Earth. However, that's where the similarities kind of stop.
How so?
Oh, this planet goes around its sun in a matter of days.
Oh.
So 100 times faster than our planet does, and the surface temperature has been estimated at excess of 2,000 degrees.
Ooh.
So it's probably molten rock. But being able to detect these types of planets will mean that we'll be able to detect other things, and the technology is just really jumping out there, especially with the Kepler spacecraft.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about the Kepler. What have they given us recently?
Well, Kepler is main job is we can see in this wobbling thing, we can really see really big planets, but we know from experience in our own solar system that the big planets, Jupiter and Saturn, aren't suitable for life. And Kepler is looking for planets that are smaller, that would be Earth-like, that would be the right distance, or what we like to call the Goldilocks distance, away from the star, the place not too close, too hot, or too far away, or too cold. And Kepler is doing that. And we found some good candidates where some of the planets that Kepler has found could have liquid water on them. The temperature would be right. And Kepler's technology is amazing. For example, this is my favorite analogy that a scientist told me. If you take a look at a skyscraper in a big city and have all the lights in the skyscraper, Kepler would be able to look at that skyscraper at night and tell you if somebody pulled one of the shades down in one of the windows.
Whoa. Isn't that something? That is now, and the Kepler is, have they given us, what will they give us? Will they give us, if they're so advanced right now and they've given us possibilities of life could be on these planets, are we led to believe that in their future discoveries, we will determine that there will be even more places where life could exist?
Oh, definitely. In fact, Kepler is one step in that, in the scientific process. Kepler will help us identify the best candidates for the possibility of life or an Earth-like planet to investigate further. And then the next step will be whatever that next generation of technology that we can develop is to have another space telescope look at those individual planet systems or star systems and determine, are there processes on those planets that are that is something that's similar to Earth? Is it Earth-like? Which is very, very impressive. And it's just a one more step. As we peel back the onion, we find out there's more layers that we have to go through. But boy, this is a, I mean, as little as a generation ago, astronomers would tell you, yeah, there have to be planets out there. Just because we can't see them doesn't mean they don't exist because we don't have the ability to see them. Now we're having the ability to detect them. And then who knows what another generation will bring.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the scientific process, Alan. I read that with the discovery of this new planet in Alpha Centauri, that you needed confirmation that they can say we made this discovery, but there has to be verification by who?
Well, what you want to do is all science needs to be replicatable. So, in fact, one of the earliest, and this is a kind of a sad story, one of the first people to ever declare that they found an exoplanet outside of our solar system, found a planet that, yes, the star wobbled, which was the wobbling technique, and the amazing part is the planet that was going around that star was making the star wobble exactly in the same time frame as the Earth moving around the sun. And it turns out that the star wasn't wobbling. It was actually the motion of the Earth that was causing the wobble. Now, that hasn't happened since. And as with all science, yeah, we make mistakes, and we strive not to make that mistake again, and that mistake has never been made again. So we want to make sure, and these guys, the people who did this, had to really make sure that they were factoring all the motions in. Alpha Centauri is a double, possibly a triple star system. So not only do you have the planet making the parent star wobble a little bit, but that star is going around another star. And all this is moving around, and these two stars in the Alpha Centauri system are about the same distance as the sun to the outer planets of our solar system, so they're going around each other. And that causes some wobbling, too. So they had to watch this and make sure that everything was, that they could attribute all the motions to what they could see and then find out what the motions that they couldn't attribute to anything were being caused by.
Who's doing the best work on Earth in this area? Is it the United States, and do we have any kind of competition among nations?
I think it's a friendly competition. But there's at least two missions that I know of that are using technology similar to what Kepler is doing, which is pretty cool because you can't see the planet wobble when you have a small planet. So what Kepler does is it looks at the star and waits. And if this planet comes around and crosses in front of the star in Kepler's view, Kepler will measure how much the brightness of the star decreases. And this can be a fraction of a fraction of a percent.
Goodness.
And it will measure that light curve, and it'll see a dip in the light curve, and then the dip will come back up when the planet leaves the front and goes around again. And from that information, it will determine its speed, how big it is, because it can tell how much light it blocked, and then determine its orbit. The tricky part is it needs to confirm that. It may detect it, but they'll have to go back again and detect that as it cycles through all the stars in that area. What happened with Alpha Centauri is not the oldest way of discovering planets, but the medium way of actually watching the planet wobble. And that version was a lot easier for us because the star happened to be so close.
Hmm. How long has Kepler been around, Alan?
Kepler has been around for several years. They figure out by the end of its mission, they expect it to have discovered 15,000 planets.
Whoa! Seriously?
Seriously.
Whoa!
So after it does its mission, it's a fantastic spacecraft, of course, named after Johannes Kepler, who actually, we still use his laws, and his laws are being used when they discovered these planets to determine how fast they are, how far away they are from the star. So it's kind of a great namesake, and our knowledge is just increasing as our technology increases.
And how long is the mission?
I'm not sure right offhand right now, but I think it has maybe 5 years left in it. And it really depends. And as we've been seeing with our NASA missions, our spacecraft are doing really well. We still have Opportunity running around on Mars 7 years after it was supposed to stop running. Voyager 1, we're getting very convinced that it's getting to the point of the end of our solar system and we'll start going into interstellar space. That was launched back in 1977. So all these spacecraft are doing really well. And my favorite thing about Mars is we have so much stuff at Mars, we actually have satellites taking pictures of our rovers.
Goodness.
So we can actually check out. In fact, they actually timed Curiosity's landing when it was craned down to the surface of Mars when one of our Mars orbiters was going over it, and the Mars orbiter actually took pictures of it descending. So...
Alan Pesch is our guest the first half hour of the show. He's director of the Barlow Planetarium in Menasha, which is well worth your visit. We'll talk about special things going on there, too, as we continue. I want to talk to him about meteor showers. I know there was a spectacular one last week. Can we plan those? Do we know when they're taking place? And how spectacular was it? What did he see and was able to talk about at the planetarium? And any other news in space? We're doing a space half hour, prompted, of course, by the discovery of a new planet last week. 800, if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. You can also send us an email message, which is talk@wpr.org, or leave messages for us on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dent Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join our conversation, please do. 800-486-8655 is our number. Alan Pesch is joining us from the Barlow Planetarium in Menasha, where he is director of that lovely spot. Mac in Prairie du Chien is our first caller for you. Alan, hi, Mac.
Hello. I'm curious about the James Webb Space Telescope. Is it still on track? And when do you think it might get launched?
Mac, that is going to be the next step it's the replacement for the Hubble Space Telescope, and I'd have to look up, and I know they're working on it because I get updates on it all the time on when they're adjusting stuff and putting things together. The the James Webb Telescope is going to be able to look back in the universe to a point of probably just maybe 5% of the age of the universe after the Big Bang. And just like the Hubble Space Telescope literally rewrote the rules of astronomy, the Webb scope will do the same thing. The Webb scope is using a slightly different technology. It is actually going out to a Lagrange point of the Earth-Sun system. And what's going to happen is it will always be facing away from the sun, and live in the shadow of the Earth, which is kind of cool, and it will be able to operate constantly looking out into that distance. Now, the bad news is, and one of the reasons I was so happy that they kept the Hubble Space Telescope going with their last servicing mission, I don't think many of the images coming from the Webb Space Telescope are going to be those jaw-dropping, beautiful images that we got used to with the Hubble Space Telescope. But the science, for people who are really understanding the science and looking at the wavelengths that the Webb will be looking at, the data that they'll be collecting will be jaw-dropping for them. So we're hopefully undoing or figuring out the puzzle of this universe that we're living in, and these two space telescopes have done a gigantic amount to do that sort of stuff.
Hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mac, for the call. Michael in Bear Valley. Hi.
Hello. I've got a two-part question. One is, I was hoping your guests could explain a little bit about habitable zones in which the planets are found in. And also, is there a relationship between the speed at which a planet circles its sun and the possibility of habitability? In other words, are some of these planets going so fast that that life couldn't possibly take place on them? Thank you. I'll listen.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Yes, both those two are very, very close related. The habitable zone around a star is the place that's not too close and not too far away. If we look at just at our own solar system, for example, Mercury, whose surface temperature is close to 1,000 degrees, 800 degrees in the daytime, about 400 below zero at night, that is not a habitable planet for us. It gets baked in the sunlight and gets cooled off when it's not pointing at the sun. Venus is another case like that. However, Venus is even hotter due to its carbon dioxide atmosphere that traps the heat. Then you have Earth, and Earth is a very nice temperature. We have most of our planets covered with water. Our life has to have water. And then you have Mars, and probably early on in our solar system, when the sun put out a little bit more energy, Earth was probably a little bit closer to the hot zone, but Mars was actually in the habitable zone. And even with Curiosity now, we're seeing evidence that, and even Opportunity and Spirit showed us too, that it looks like there was water settling, flowing on Mars, that Mars was once a wet planet. And that habitable zone has to do with that water. If it's too close, it vaporizes and turns and disappears into space. If it's too far away, it's frozen, it's ice, like the moons of Jupiter, the ice caps of Mars. Now, the speed of the planet is actually tied to its distance from the star itself, and that's what Kepler taught us hundreds of years ago, that the closer you are, the gravity wants to pull you in, so you have to be going fast enough to stay away. The further out you go, the gravity decreases, so you get to go slower. So the fastest planets in our solar system are Mercury and Venus. The slowest ones are Uranus, Neptune, and the dwarf planet Pluto. So the speed of the planet is really dependent upon how close it is, which also means whether it's in the habitable zone or not.
Mm. Did you see, tell me more about last week's meteor shower. It was all over the news. This is going to be spectacular. Were you able to see it?
I was out early Sunday morning, and I'm sad to say I saw a few of them, but not as many as I would have liked for a meteor shower. The Orion and meteor shower, and one of your questions was, can we predict these?
Right.
And yes, we do. They're an annual event. Every meteor shower is. And what happens, the Orionids actually came from the Hubble, or from the Halley's Comet. And as Halley's Comet goes around the sun every 76 years, it slowly falls apart, especially as it gets closer to the sun when it's going to be back in 2050. It's going to get closer to us and hit its closest approach to us in 2061. But it leaves a pollution trail around it in its orbit. And every year, in the middle of October, the Earth plows through that debris field. And when we plow through that debris field, these specks come into our atmosphere, typically about a typical size is probably about the size of a grain of sand. They're going very fast. They burn up at an altitude of about 40 or 50 miles. So the astronauts on the International Space Station can actually look down at the meteors. But if you're in an airplane, you're still well below them. This happens every year. And it's predictable. Now, there was a big meteor that came in over California last week.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And they actually tracked that, and some of it may have made it to the ground. That would probably have to be a much bigger piece. But typically a meteor is very small. There's only been a few instances in the history of people actually getting hit by them. My favorite one is about 15 years ago, a meteor came in over a football game, a Friday night football game out east, and it hit a 1980 Chevy Malibu.
Oh, my gosh.
Blue book value was like $50. And I think it later sold for tens of thousands.
Bet it did.
Including, and then the meteor was its own price. I think the meteor went for $65,000. So if you want the price on your car to go up and you're trying to trade it in, have it get hit by a meteor.
Let's go to Karen in Jefferson. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi. And Dr. Pesch. I was wondering now, last week on TV, I just saw a quick little blurb that went into no detail about a planet that has diamonds on it.
And could have this been part of the Martian, of what happened that with Curiosity?
I do not know.
Oh, okay. Well, Curiosity.
I mean, you read these little banners on the bottom of news that you've seen a zillion times, and you don't get any details.
And that's what happens. What happened last week, is Curiosity on Mars, actually a couple weeks ago, start actually digging on Mars. It got to a place where there's three different types of land formation, and they thought this was really cool. So they started digging. And one of the scoops that they brought up when they looked into the hole that was left, they found a shiny object. And this comes back to our verification that Kathleen talked about. We wanted to make sure that that thing that was found in the hole didn't somehow fall off the spacecraft. Hmm. And thought that this was something cool. So what they're doing is they're analyzing it and watching it and seeing what that is and see if they can find more and hopefully do a little analysis on that. But it's that this mini Cooper-sized robot that we have driving around on Mars doing this really chemistry lab and geology lab activities, trying to figure out how we fit in with the rest of the solar system and how the rest of the solar system fits in with us. So look for new discoveries and stuff coming from that Curiosity rover. It's got a limited time frame on Mars, but like all Mars missions, it's got it can last for a very long time, and its electricity to drive its motors should last for well over 10 years.
Thanks, Karen. What if they discovered diamonds on Mars? What does that do to the whole space race? Really? Thanks, Karen, for the call. Joe and Franklin, hi.
Morning, Kathleen. I have a question. My wife and I were talking about this yesterday, and during the summer, I think it's the summer solstice, if you're up at the North Pole, the sun never sets. Does it look like the sun is just sitting in one spot as
Earth
turns around it? And what about the moon? How does the moon look to them up there? I mean, does the moon never set?
That's an interesting, that is really cool. And one of the best ways to do that is with, and I may post a program on the Barlow Planetarium Facebook to show you, and you can play with that.
Oh.
What happens is when you're up there, the sun actually does go around you, but during a portion of the day, it will get lower in the north and higher in the south, but it will never dip under the horizon. Now, the moon follows the same basic path through our sky as the sun does, except when you have a full moon, it's in the position in the summertime that the sun is in the wintertime. So they may not, during a full moon, they may not see a full moon in the sky ever on the North Pole in the summertime. In the wintertime, they would probably see it. So it's kind of cool. You watch the sun go around, and you can kind of see this happening in Wisconsin. In the wintertime, the sun is going to be rising up in the southeast, goes low in the sky in the south, and goes down in the southwest. When we hit the solstices or the equinoxes, the sun comes up in the east and goes down in the west. But when we get to the longest day of the winter or longest day of the summer in June, the sun actually comes up in the northeast and goes way up high in the sky and comes down in the northwest. The further north you get, the closer those points get behind you until you get to the above the Arctic Circle. And at the above the Arctic Circle, the sun will start to just touch the horizon behind you before it starts going back up and come down. And the higher you go, the sun will get a little bit higher above the northern horizon. So you can actually tell the time, literally, by going outside and seeing where the sun is.
Huh. Do they ever have a time up there where the moon never sets for them?
Probably a full moon. Remember, that moon is constantly changing position throughout the month, which is where the word month comes from. But there is a time that in the wintertime, so around December 21st, if there's a full moon around that time, that moon will be over the horizon all the time for them as it goes around for that day.
Huh. Interesting.
And that causes problems. You'd be surprised. Depression goes up when there's no sun in the sky.
Oh, I'm sure.
You have to literally turn on. And then the other side of the equation is in the summertime, you have to have shades on your windows. Otherwise, you'll never get to sleep because the sun's always up.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Joe. I'm glad you and your wife were having this conversation yesterday.
Well, thank you.
Now we've all had it. Thanks. Thanks for calling. Alan, what's up at the planetarium? Special events?
Well, we have our rock laser shows back in our theater through January. But what's really cool is this weekend, every month on the Saturday following the first quarter moon, we have a family astronomy night, and that gives us an opportunity for have our guests come out in the evening, see our planetarium shows. But if it's clear, we also have telescopes out to look at the moon mostly and whatever stuff else is in the sky, and an opportunity to do kind of a star talk, not under our artificial, wonderful stars of the Barlow Planetarium, but we can actually go outside and look at the constellations outside and let people see and figure out how to measure them so they can get an idea of what it looks like outside and share that. And especially at this time of year, Kathleen, when we're getting to be more dark than light during the day,
yes,
it's a wonderful time to take a look at the stars and get reacquainted with
them. Oh, I'm sure, Alan. Thank you so much. We're heading up there to do a show Thursday on the Da Vinci exhibit. We'll try and stop by and say hi to you.
Fantastic. Looking forward to it.
Thanks, Alan. Alan Pesch, director of the Barlow Planetarium. It's a great place in Menasha, and as you can tell, Alan is just, he loves his job, and he does great exhibits and is terribly enthusiastic about everything related to the world above us. And he is the director of the planetarium there. Well, that was fun. So, last week this happened, and, you know, these stories, you wonder how in the world people have the audacity to do something like this and what they do with all of these paintings. There was a high-profile art heist at the Kunsthal in Rotterdam last Tuesday. Thieves took seven paintings on loan from a foundation, including works by Monet and Matisse, Gauguin and Picasso. And last Wednesday morning, the museum opened with replacement paintings from the Triton Foundation. But how do you go about finding these missing works of art? How in the world could somebody get into this museum and take these works? What do you do with them? Can you resell these works? Is there a black market on these? This next part of our program, we're going to be speaking with Anthony Amore, who is the author, co-author of Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Anthony as well. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can also leave messages for us on the our Facebook page. And Rhonda reminds me that she has just posted a link to the discovery of the Diamond Planet on Facebook, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Anthony. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I read about these events and I think, how in the world could these possibly happen? You can't imagine anybody would ever get away with this. You would think security would be all over the place. And then I got five questions at once. What do you do with these paintings once you get them? Are these kinds of thefts fairly carefully laid out?
In terms of planning, you mean?
Yes. Yes.
Well, you know, they run the gamut, but what you typically see is that these thieves who commit these crimes aren't very sophisticated. It's just a crime of opportunity, and oftentimes there's an insider who provides information, which makes these a bit easier.
Mm-hmm. They're not very sophisticated. You would think that they would be because of all the alarms that would go off and that it would be kind of tricky to do something like this.
Well, you know, that's true. But when you think about the security at a museum relative to other places that have high-value items, it's a bigger challenge for a museum because when you compare it to, say, a bank or a jewelry store, the whole point of a museum is accessibility to these high-end items. So there's that one less layer of security which makes high-value art attractive to thieves.
Mm-hmm. Somebody in commenting on the theft at Rotterdam said anybody planning such a theft would have had some idea or in some form about what they might do with the pictures. What would you do with them? People know that they're stolen, don't they?
Well, you know, that's funny, that posting, because what is often the case is that these thieves don't have an idea what to do with them. They have something in the back of their mind, just an assumption, I would say, that they can fence something that's worth so much money. But in reality, it's incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to do so.
How many art thefts, notorious thefts, have there been? Is it really a rarity or not?
Oh, it's amazing. I couldn't even put a number on them. In the book Stealing Rembrandts, I catalog all of the Rembrandt thefts that have occurred in the last 100 years, and there were 81.
Whoa!
Right, and 3 weeks after my book came out, an 82nd occurred. They're incredibly common. If I always mention in talks and interviews that if you go to Google News and you type in art theft, every couple of days you're going to see something that has occurred.
That's absolutely amazing.
Staggering. As a matter of fact, you know, the one story that got very little press, the same day that the Kunsthal theft was announced, a painting by Lichtenstein was returned after having been stolen 42 years earlier. But, of course, the story was buried with the fact that the Kunsthal had lost so many pieces.
Mm-hmm. And so do these paintings often resurface or not?
Well, in the sense of great masterpieces, highly recognizable works, those are recovered far more frequently than lesser-known works. Sometimes it's estimated that masterpieces are recovered around 70% of the time. But what you usually see is that they're either recovered right away, the thieves see the folly of their act and return them, or somebody snitches on them, or they're returned a generation later. So there's this big gap in terms of when these pieces are recovered, and unfortunately a lot of them disappear for quite some time.
Hmm. So if something is stolen, if you were director of a museum, is there a system that's put in place automatically of trying to locate it?
It depends on the museum. At the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in 1990 was the biggest property theft in world history, never mind art heist. And that museum has a provision in Mrs. Gardner's will which says nothing can ever be replaced. So the response to it is strictly recovery. In other museums, like the Kunsthal, other pieces might be put into place. But what's key is that the museum work very closely with prosecutors and investigators to make sure that there's a vigorous effort to recover the pieces.
Is there some question about whether or not they should and do they pay for tips?
Well, you know, the best example, again, is the Gardner Museum, which has a $5 million reward for information.
Whoa.
Right. It's the biggest private reward ever offered, and it's for information which leads directly to the recovery of the paintings. But what you want to do is be careful to differentiate a reward from a ransom, which could be very controversial in the art world.
Mm-hmm. And how often is there a ransom associated with these thefts?
Probably the most famous example would be money paid by the Tate Gallery back about 10 years ago now to recover two stolen Turners. Some people call it a ransom, some call it a reward. But I think that, generally speaking, no one can fault a museum for doing everything it can to get back its unique, priceless works of art.
Do you know the details of that? Did the people who took the paintings write to somebody and say, we've got these paintings, we want you to pay so much? Who would write to, who you deal with in terms of turning over the money?
Well, it's it's funny you'd ask because it's such an incredibly complicated story. But essentially, the Tate Gallery had loaned three pieces to a museum in Germany, from which they were stolen, and the people who stole them were caught pretty quickly. But the people who are holding them, which turned out to be members of the Serbian mob.
Oh, my gosh.
Dealing through an attorney, an incredible art theft recovery agent by the name of Rocky Rakosinski, who's actually a friend of mine, a real movie-type figure, recovered them and worked with the museum to pay the reward or ransom money.
Hmm. Is part of the problem that there's not sophisticated enough security?
I think the security is sophisticated enough. I think that museums present sort of a good scenario for thieves in the sense that, again, they don't, because the goal is accessibility to these pieces of art, thieves are aware of this. And when I say that, I mean, if you go into a high-end jewelry store, or you're not surprised if you find that the jewels are behind very thick bulletproof glass, that there may be armed guards there, that you have to be buzzed in and out of the jewelry store. However, when you come to a museum, the goal of the museum is to let the visitor have an intimate experience, mm-hmm. to be close to it, and to get as close as possible without touching. So that's just something I think that thieves are aware of, and they see that the opportunity for a smash-and-grab type theft is maybe greater in a museum, so they do it. That being said, when there's a robbery of a jewelry store, even in your own town, it might make the evening news, it might not. But when a piece by Picasso goes stolen, it's a headline grabber. So you hear about it more often, and it seems that museums are more susceptible to theft when that might not be the case.
Now, are there places, and if so, what would they be, if you've taken a Picasso or a Monet, where you could sell them to somebody? So, because it seems the purpose of taking one of these would be to make some money. Are there places, and if so, what would those be that would buy a painting?
I can't name one. When I did this research on the Rembrandt thefts, I didn't find a single instance where the paintings were stolen for someone to actually make money. Sometimes paintings are stolen as a get-out-of-jail-free card, where somebody might hold it in case they get in trouble for their other criminal endeavors and to maybe barter their way out of a lengthy sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of finding a buyer, the more well-known and highly visible a painting is, the more difficult it is to fence. And it's pretty obvious why. When you think about it, a person who has a lot of money is not going to even give you pennies on a dollar for a multi-million dollar painting that they can never show anybody. I often give the example, the reason that Ferraris are red and yellow is because people want to be noticed in them. People don't buy these cars or these paintings because they want to hide them from the world. They want to show them off. So it's incredibly difficult to sell them. And in doing so, fencing these stolen paintings is a fool's errand. It just basically can't be done.
Anthony Amore is our guest this half hour of the program. He's author of Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists, and there have been many of them. Our attention drawn to this because we found it interesting, this high-profile burglary at the Kunsthal in Rotterdam last week, where there were gorgeous paintings on loan from Triton Foundation, Monet and Matisse and Gauguin and Picasso and others, and we wondered about how you could steal something like this, and then what do you do with a painting like this? And our guest knows all about it. If you'd like to join our conversation, feel free to call us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email, if you'd like to send a message that way, is talk@wpr.org. And you can always go to our Facebook page, too, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this part of the show is Anthony Amore, author of Stealing Rembrandt's The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. Join us if you'd like. If not, you can just listen, of course. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number. I was reading in a piece, I think, in the Times about the FBI having an art crime team that gathers intelligence on all of this. Is this tell me about this team. Are they pretty sophisticated? Are they getting valuable information?
Well, the team consists of about a dozen FBI agents spread around the country, and they don't work solely on art crime. It's sort of a collateral duty for them, but they do a lot of training. There's a program manager in Washington by the name of Bonnie Magnus Gardner, who's fantastic, and she accumulates a lot of info. And every bit that they can put together from the data they collect is useful. I think it's the beginning of a trend in the United States to take this type of art theft more seriously.
Hmm. And where do you find most art theft? Is it in Europe or in the U.S.?
There's a tremendous amount of art theft in Europe, more than there is in the United States. For obvious reasons, I mean, there are so many churches in Italy that have tremendous pieces of art and altarpieces that are susceptible to theft. So you have a lot more. There's a lot more people there investigating it. France is subject to the same sort of thing. But we have a horrible amount here in the United States, and at least half of it occurs out of people's private collections in their homes, which is something that surprises people who follow this sort of thing. So, yeah, it's a real problem here in America.
Mm-hmm. They're private collections, so who would have access to those? How would you know somebody has a...
Well, that question leads exactly to the sort of person who does it. Oftentimes, you have a contractor in your home, a housekeeper, a babysitter, that sort of thing, and they might notice that you have a Rembrandt etching on your wall or a Picasso piece or that sort of thing. And when word spreads, that just catches the ear of thieves who again, see the opportunity to take something that they might not be able to fence. On the flip side, too, I did mention how difficult it is to fence these highly recognizable masterpieces, but there are lesser-known works that are stolen incredibly often and are sold and slip into legitimate markets as well. So art theft is thought to be, or estimated to be, about a $6 billion a year illicit industry worldwide.
$6 billion a year?
Yep, a tremendous amount of art switches hands and is stolen.
Wow. You mentioned the number of Rembrandts that had been stolen. Is he the most stolen artist? And if so, why he might be?
Well, that's a difficult one to answer because it is said that Picasso is the most stolen artist. If you look at the top 10 most stolen artists, they're all contemporary artists except for Rembrandt. When you think about the number of pieces stolen per capita, say, the amount of pieces the artist produced, Rembrandt would be the most stolen because he produced far less than Picasso, who was prolific. The reason why, though, it's not a surprise that Rembrandt would be ranked so highly in true Picasso as well, is that most people know who these guys are. Even people who didn't finish high school, say, would know, if you asked them name a great artist, they would say Rembrandt or Picasso. Mm-hmm. And these types of people also know that great artists are synonymous with high-value art. So that makes them targets, again, because they're so well-known and so great. Every major city has pieces by, say, Rembrandt. So he's just out there, valuable, and that's kind of a perfect storm for them.
Mm. Have you uncovered any very unusual stories of somebody living in a tiny town somewhere and they had a vision that they were supposed to have this Rembrandt masterpiece in their house, and they were obsessed with this painting forever, and they just stole in quietly. They weren't really a criminal, but they just wanted the painting close to them.
Kathleen, I love that question because that was the impetus for the book I wrote.
Oh, really?
it is because the public sees art theft as something done by these really debonair thieves, these master crooks. Like in the Thomas Crown Affair, but in reality, art theft is much more like a Coen Brothers film. People who do these crimes are from every walk of life and very quirky characters. I mentioned in the book about this painting by Rembrandt called the Portrait of Jacob de Guyn, which is stolen four times from the same museum in Britain. And every time it was stolen gives you a different view as to who steals art. The first time the guy stole it because he thought he could fence it. The second person to steal it walked into the museum while it was open, took it off the wall, put it on the back of his bike, and rode off.
Whoa.
And when he was caught minutes later, he said he just wanted to take it home to sketch it.
Oh.
And then the latter two thefts were by these crime gangs who thought they could monetize the painting, and both times they just gave it back because they couldn't.
Hmm.
So all these major art thefts always have a very strange component. I saw the video from this Kunsthal heist. I saw the closed circuit television video. And the theft occurs in 56 seconds.
Wow.
And these guys just come in, they jimmy a door, and they walk in and they walk out. And it's nothing like you picture in Hollywood.
What were they wearing?
They had on hats to kind of disguise their identity and hoods. The video isn't perfect in terms of being able to tell exactly what they were wearing, but you couldn't identify them. And they took the paintings out in bags. And in my estimation, they clearly had inside information. I mean, to pull off this heist in 56 seconds,
right,
grab these seven high-value paintings, I mean, you don't do that by luck.
Yeah, that's a pretty short period of time. An email from Al from Silver Lake, who wanted to know if museums ever display replicas instead of the real thing for security purposes.
No, I've never heard of that as an instance. Not for security. Sometimes a replica of a piece, highly accurate replica of a piece, will be shown to buy the real piece some time out of the light to help preserve it. But in terms of to safeguard the actual piece, no. That would be an incredibly, I believe, an incredibly unethical thing to do for an institution.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, this museum had these pictures on loan from, I don't know what this Triton Foundation is. What kind of responsibility do they have to the Triton Foundation to make sure those paintings are returned, and will they have to pay them some money?
I don't think they'll have to pay them anything. I'm sure, well, I shouldn't say I'm sure, but in the vast majority of times, it would be highly unusual if the paintings weren't insured. Typically, when a painting is loaned, especially works of this caliber, they're insured for that loan. And secondly, when you loan a piece, the typical procedure would be the loaning institution or body will have the people who are receiving it meet certain security specifications. So the Triton Foundation most likely had provided the Kunsthal with a list of security precautions that had to be in place.
Are there some museums that are state-of-the-art in this regard, and it would behoove all other institutions to look at the security, and it may be even simple things that places have done that guard against theft?
Well, the short answer to that would be the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston has a state-of-the-art security procedure in place, but I'm biased because I'm the security director there.
So, oh, you are?
Yes. So it's a little unfair for me to quote that, but I think museum security is really coming of age. There are some really great experts out there lending advice to museums. But oftentimes, museums and other institutions take the approach that it can't happen here. And until they're burned by thieves, they don't pay proper attention.
Mm-hmm.
That's a scary prospect.
Joe in Waterloo. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I'm curious. When they steal them, how do they take them out of the museum? Do they take the entire frame? Do they cut them out? I assume that must mess them up completely. Do they roll them? So on.
It's a good question, Joe. They're taken in every variety of method you can imagine. I keep a database of different art crimes to examine just that type of thing. We've got about 1,200 in there and just mesmerized by the different methods there. Sometimes they're cut. Infrequent that they're rolled because usually if you have an old painting, you'll see the folly of your move. As soon as you start to roll it, you'll probably see that you're damaging it. But they are often cut. Sometimes they're taken out of the frame on their stretcher and removed. Sometimes the whole frame is. A lot of times what governs that is the size of the painting. If it's very large or if the frame is very ornate, they will take it from the frame. But God, the methods that are used are just limited only by imagination.
Hmm. And thanks very much for the call. Well, thank you, Anthony. This has been fascinating. I appreciate your time.
Your questions are great. Thank you.
Thanks. Anthony Amore, author of Stealing Rembrandt's The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. And that's it for the show for this Monday. We'll be with you tomorrow. Tomorrow during this time period, we're going to be talking about about Dr. Martin Luther King and a play that I saw over the weekend at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater, which is very interesting. Takes place at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis the night before he was assassinated. And we'll be talking with the playwright and director tomorrow during this time period. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produce this program. A reminder, tonight, third presidential debate and all of the broadcasting will begin at 7 o'clock and then the debate at 8 o'clock. So you can hear all of that tonight here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great conversations are ahead.